music that has an absence of singing and words, when it is intriguing and holds your attention, is I find that increasingly rare, and it's something that has always really inspired me a lot.
This is Something from Nothing, a podcast about the creative process and the individuals involved. I'm Justin Lewis. Tremendously talented people who carry themselves with true humility are hard to come by, but are very fun to hang out with. And that is exactly the situation I found myself in when I went to Nashville to interview Hawktail. Well, three-fourths of Hawktail. The trio that met me at Brittany Hawes' home.
I'm Jordan Tice. I play guitar.
I'm Paul Coward. I play bass.
And of course.
And I'm Brittany Hawes, and I play the fiddle.
The missing member was Dominic Leslie, who plays mandolin. And he may have been missing, but he was not forgotten.
It's been really great having Dom in the band. And he brings a rhythmic feel that balances really well with our instruments and our personalities. And he has a real playful quality in the way that he approaches music. And sometimes it's silly, and sometimes he plays, he just has ideas that none of us would think of.
We all have our ups and downs, but he's pretty in tune with a calm, good vibe. He provides that to us. And he's a lot of fun to be on the road with.
So the interview looked like this. We sat in a circle, Paul and me in chairs, Brittany and Jordan were seated on the couch, and we passed my handheld mic around the circle. The first question I asked was how the band formed. Without knowing exactly who to hand the mic to, I used my manners. Ladies first.
We have all been friends for a long time, so we met about 10 years ago and just started playing music for fun at that point. And we had kind of similar interests in the kind of music that we liked listening to and what we were excited about playing and learning. So we kind of bonded over that. And then as the years went by, we all had various different projects that we were doing and people we were touring with. And we had stayed in touch and we're still playing music here and there on the side. And then eventually there was kind of a gap in everybody's schedules that made sense for us to actually form a band and try to do that as a real project. And that was in 2013. Yeah, 2013. Okay. And we were all living up in the Northeast at that point in between Boston and New York. And so we started getting together and working on this music that Jordan and Paul had been writing. And then I wrote some tunes, and we ended up making our first record at that point as a trio. I'll let you continue the story.
Here's Jordan.
Yeah, and then basically after recording and releasing that and then touring that first record under the name Hoskort Tice, which is our three last names, we kind of got to work on a new crop of tunes, and we really recorded it in 3.5 times, two times before realizing that we really needed a fourth member to kind of fill the music out. And, if we really wanted to kind of take this seriously, it should be a permanent fourth member. So that's when we asked our friend Dominic Leslie, who plays mandolin, and we've made a bunch of music together. Paul's worked with him before, and I had made a bluegrass record called Horse County in 2016, of which Dom was an integral part. So it just seemed like the most natural fit for a fourth member. And that's our band as it exists today.
Paul shared this when it came to his reasoning behind adding the mandolin.
There was a general sense, listening to the music that we had written and that we had been trying to perform and record, there was an emptiness, just a vacant spot that needed to be filled in the sound. You know, the mandolin has a has a rhythmic force that really makes it unique and occupies a very certain spot in the acoustic ensemble, like a bluegrass band, that you really can't get another way.
It became obvious they're all good friends. It even affects their songwriting, or as I learned, tune writing. A song has words where instruments only, that's a tune. Speaking of tunes, we talked about a few of them on their latest album.
Unless is a tune that started with a small theme that I always knew was really good. So, like, I had this for years. And used to go, like, right up to that next note. I had all these different ways of developing it, and it got a little further and then couldn't go anywhere. And it wasn't until the band kind of collectively decided, it's like, well, wait, we should have this is a tune that should do what Festin does, which is a tune that we were playing at the time. It's a modern Swedish tune by Eva Sather. I'm not really sure how she says her name, but do you think it's like that, Britt? Yeah. Ava. So we had been playing a tune of hers called Festin, and we really liked it because everyone could play the melody in a way that we each felt was really beautiful on our respective instruments, which is for a guitar and a fiddle and a bass, not the smallest feat. There aren't many tunes in our repertoire that really exemplify that. And that was something that was really nice about that tune, and it allowed us to develop an arrangement for it that we really liked. So we wanted a tune that was like that. And it wasn't until everybody in the band, it wasn't me, I don't know, maybe you, Jordan, was like, make it like Festin, you know? And then it took about 3 days to finish. Having a really clear, our sights clear for the development of it was what took it from being a little idea that kicked around for years to being a complete tune. And the arrangement really, the bulk of the arrangement followed suit pretty quickly as well. That's an example. I wrote that melody and sort of in the bass line, but it really, the sound of that tune really features Britt's interpretation of that melody on the fiddle, and Jordan is the most untethered person in the band often, but really on that song. And you kind of cultivated a complex guitar arrangement over the course of 5 cycles of the melody.
Randy is a song Jordan brought to the band, with the melody and the chords pretty much finished. Paul described his input on the tune.
And I kind of developed the climax of the arrangement and cultivated a bass line and stuff that I really wanted to do on the tune.
Some of the songs are very collaborative between the band members. Paul said Frog and Toad took many hours kicking around ideas and seeing where it could go. The other tune mentioned?
Brit Git is another one that we kind of put together pretty well, but it really comes from melody fragments that you had.
Yeah, I had an A part and a B part that were like barely, I mean, you could call them an A part and a B part, but they're like really like one phrase each. And I was playing it on the mandolin at the time, and then Paul and I wrote a third part to it. And yeah, that tune is pretty simple and kind of just like silly. And then I ended up playing guitar and Jordan played mandolin on it. And that one is the only track on there that's just a trio.
And then like Abzug, the first track, Brittany wrote the melody entirely. It's a fiddle tune. The fiddle is the lead from the beginning to the end. And but she wrote the melody over a support structure that Jordan and I came up with.
Before the melody
ever existed, yeah.
Yeah, and that was something that we kind of really started with a concept before any of the music was written. Like, Brittany Haas is one of the most acclaimed and forceful old-time fiddle players, extemporaneous old-time fiddle players in America, if not the most. Right? And we were like... And we were kind of like... We don't really have a tune where Brittany just completely, like, shreds. And wouldn't it be cool if we did? You know, something where she could get all her crazy bowings and, like, that super, like, jagged, like, metal thing that she can do that makes people go crazy. We're like, we need to have that. That's like something, that's like one of the coolest things that anybody in this group can possibly do. So we need to have a tune that can do that. But then at the same time, we're also like, how do we do it in a way that's not like the most obvious way? You know, where it's like just like a slamming rhythmic bed and then Brittany's just kind of shredding for a few minutes. So that's when we kind of decided, like, oh, what if we kind of came up with the rhythmic bed and the arrangement for what me and Paul's parts, his bass line and my strumming thing first, and then wrote the tune on top of that. So there's more going on than it just being this kind of what's the word, kind of one-dimensional rhythmic bed that she's just shredding over, you know. So everybody has like a little role to play. That's interesting.
I told the band how their music held my attention, and that is unusual for an all-instrumental album. Part of my curiosity was, do they intentionally write the music with the audience in mind, like a short attention span audience, such as myself?
For me anyways, it's not super conscious at that stage. Yeah. It's more like hoping that it's good and then seeing what they think once you get to the stage where you get in front of people.
I would say, like, obviously it's not like, you know, like certain types of like pop music where like they're like, this song is really, really... racking up the numbers. So if we make things like it, people will gravitate towards it. But it's almost like, I think we think of ourselves as like spectators, you know. We think of the effect that music does have on people, and then by way of people that study that and, you know, are crafts people of that art form, we try to take that knowledge of the way things are perceived and build that into the music, you know, and make musical decisions that, I mean, obviously you don't have any control over whether anybody likes it, but you do have control over, I think, whether it's a clear statement, whether it does something. So okay. I guess in those words, we are thinking of the audience, but, I would, you know, beyond that, I think it's, we are not.
Their studio recorded album does include some live performance versions, and the band explained how this happened.
Basically, we had recorded studio versions of those songs and basically just decided that we play them better live. And we did have this one tour booked before the record was actually out, so we decided to record in high def on good mics every single one of those shows in hopes of capturing some of those tracks that we just felt we played better live. And we actually ended up, we originally were just going to do one live track, but then we ended up with two additional ones that we liked the live versions better than the studio versions.
So what was the, why would you say you did it better live?
It has to do with, so Horps Reel was the one that we were out to get live. Horps Reel, we set out to record it many times, and we always ended up playing it too slow, and it didn't have any life in it for some reason. It's like there's a spooky quality to that tune, but when we're in the studio, we just fetishized that spooky quality, and it didn't have any force behind it. The adrenaline of the live show really brought a tangible quality to the performance. That drive. You know, and it can have a variety of effects. You know, sometimes it's just that you're comfortable because you're not thinking about microphones. Sometimes it's the adrenaline that gives you a forward kind of motion, you know. Sometimes it's just a good night. You know, everybody's feeling good. You know, it's just, I guess that's all to say that we really prioritize the live performances of this music. It's not the way that recordings always come out. You know, some people, the way their music works, it's like more important that it has a huge sound or a consistency in like a quantized kind of regularity. Like, and that's really not what we're all about. And having three live tracks on a record that we recorded in the studio three times kind of proves that.
Two of the three were in Ferndale, California. The venue?
The Old Steeple. And that was a memorable concert because it was so nice to play in there. Mm-hmm.
Barn owls.
There are barn owls.
And there's a child. You can hear a kid going.
Yeah, yeah. In the
aisle.
Near the end of Horps Reel, there's a really quiet moment, and you can hear a little kid give a squeal. But I guess listening to the record, you never know what that was. It just sounds spooky and crazy because it's this reverberant church.
That's true. You wouldn't really know what it was. But when I found out, I went to the track as soon as I had the chance, and I took a listen. I've taken the liberty to help you out. Listen to the very end of the applause. One more time, the very end. Jordan talked about the other live track on the album, El Camino Part 2.
It was recorded at kind of like a, I don't want them, they probably won't hear this, but like a kind of dingy rock club, which is kind of like an outlier in terms of funky. Yeah, funky. A funky rock club that was kind of like an outlier in terms of like the venues we're used to playing. And also that show, we kind of we had this beer that was a little stronger than we kind of were expecting. It kind of hit its alcohol content pretty well, so it's just kind of this weird situation. But for that tune, it kind of gave us this just kind of reckless edge to the whole thing that really suited the tune, and it was something that we probably couldn't cultivate anywhere else. You know, like the sound wasn't that great, if I remember correctly. We were just kind of all playing very hard, but you know, that tune that night went the furthest in the direction that we wanted it to go than it ever did anywhere else, kind of because of those, you know, forces.
It was the first tune we played on that show, and actually, yeah, it was track one of the show. Yeah, and these kids opened for us. I'm pretty sure it was either the first or second tune. I think we were starting with it. Jordan likes to think that he has the best memory, but sometimes I remember things. And these kids opened for us, and they're lovely, and they did an awesome job. And then we got up there, and actually I remember because I had been like editing the crap out of that track, the studio version, and I was really excited about it. I was like learning how to edit, and it was really fun. And then the guys, Paul and Jordan, were listening to the live tracks, and they called me and they're like, we actually have to use the live track of this song. And they sent it to me to listen to, and I was like, are you crazy? Like, this is awful. Because it starts with me playing the melody, and I was kind of just like flying off the rails, like playing all these crazy double stops and stuff, which I didn't think should be heard by anybody who wasn't there in that room that night. But then I came around to it because it does have a like, kind of a wildness that actually fits that tune.
And Brittany flying off the rails is a particularly wonderful sound.
Well said. Speaking of live, the band has recently been featured on the national old-timey radio show, Live From Here, where I first heard them. Paul and Brittany have also been house band musicians, and she talked about what that was like.
Okay, so there's like an email sometime early in the week with a list of the music that we're probably going to play with YouTube links. Like, here's, you know, it's Aretha Franklin's birthday, for example, and like, here's a YouTube link of the song, and then there's a list of all the songs that we do, and then you kind of figure it out, you listen, and you see what the parts are. It might be completely different instrumentation than what, I mean, not completely, I guess I see it that way, because often it's like a pop track that does not have a fiddle on it, and I'm like, I wonder if I get to be like the electric guitar, or like the trumpet, or whatever. And then we all show up in the city that it's going to be in on Friday, early afternoon, and you fly in, you go to the rehearsal, you play through all the music, you get a whole heap of charts, and just work through stuff. Usually the song of the week is the most involved thing to learn and to put together and arrange. And then that's a few hours on Friday. Have some dinner, do your own practicing. Like, there might be some kind of crazy like solo thing that somebody in the house band has to render, and it might be really hard. The singers, I think, have a little bit harder of a time, like learning all these crazy harmonies that Dilly has invented. And then Saturday morning, you show up again, rehearse again, and then do the show for 2 hours that evening. And then party.
Something From Nothing interviews typically do not end the same way. The time spent with this band ended by us chatting a little bit more, me sharing some of the times I've seen them live, and us trading merch. Or maybe a more accurate description should be that I pawned off some merch on them and I was gifted some amazing music. Also got some pretty cool posters. We also got a group picture, and my wife Erin was able to show off her knitting. Quite a unique interview. You can find out more about Hawktail on the internet, of course. They're on Facebook and Instagram at Hawktail Band. Something From Nothing is also on Instagram at Something From Nothing Podcast. And episodes from all four seasons are available on WKMS.org. This episode was edited by Taylor Inman and produced by me, your host, Justin Lewis. Thanks for listening.